From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When does tasting become punishment? That's the question, at least for me. As more restaurants move to hours-long fixed tasting menus that may require an intermission, the decision to dine and still be able to sit up or walk has become a difficult one for some Epicureans, not to mention the not-so-small fact of a bill that could equal your monthly rent. Esquire Food and Drinks editor Jeff Gordonier has the latest on the tasting menu debate. So let's start with getting a reservation. How hard is it to get a seat to many of these places that want hundreds of dollars so that they can fatten us up like geese for foie gras?
It depends. You know, it's funny. I often get the reservation question, and I have scored a lot of reservations simply by going on OpenTable and opting for weird hours, you know, like eating at 5:30 or eating at 10 at night, or I'll sort of hover around the place at a certain hour and go in there. It's not necessarily difficult at some of them. I mean, if it's the most famous locations, a Momofuku Ko or something like that, yeah, it's difficult, but not impossible.
What are some of the average costs per person for a tasting menu and also for the often recommended wine pairing?
Oh, the wine pairing. Well, you know, you see a range of costs. I mean, there are places like Contra here in New York City. I think they started out with something in the, you know, $47 or $55 range. And then you see tasting menus that go, you know, all the way up into $200, $300, $400. Or omakase sushi experiences, of course, that can run you $600 per person. And then the wine pairing will often be, oh, I don't know, 150 extra. That could be the real killer. I remember going to Atera once with some friends, and we had a cocktail before, which was probably inadvisable. And the sommelier sort of came up next to the table and said, how do you guys feel about the wine pairing? And we were feeling pretty good in general because of the cocktail. So we were like, let's do it. And then we ended up getting saddled with, I think it was a $1,400 bill, which I was paying for personally. This was not expensible, and it was just crushing.
I imagine that the cost is somewhat related to the number of courses. So what is the range of the number of courses?
That's a good question. You see certain tasting menus that I'm fond of that will have five or six courses. When we're talking about the highest price tag, they sometimes have 25 courses, 26. I think Il Bulli famously had 50. You know, often they're very tiny courses, you know, little bites, but they add up. I've had moments where I realize I'm 2/3 of the way through one of these tasting menus and I'm dying. Like, I cannot intake any more calories. I have lost any contact with pleasure. You know, that's what's really fascinating to me, is they're meant to sort of tantrically expand the notion of pleasure and, you know, extend it over hours. But you lose contact with pleasure very quickly, I find. You know, you grow bored. And also, if you make the mistake of going with people that you don't have great conversations with, you tend to hit a sandbar about an hour and a half through.
Yeah. The whole experience to me can be the epitome of inhospitable.
Yeah.
Several years ago in Vanity Fair, journalist Corby Kummer actually called chefs out for being tyrannical with no regard for how much people actually want or are able to eat. Has it gotten any better? I find that sometimes in the not super high-end restaurants, the courses actually become bigger rather than remain tiny.
Yeah, sometimes you'll feel like you're full and then they put down a steak or something, and you're like, I can't do it. You know, I remember Corby's piece well, and he took a very strong anti-tasting menu position. And then there was a piece later on that David Chang wrote sort of in defense of tasting menus. I kind of wanted to stake out a middle ground and say, most of the time, they're sort of an ordeal and you feel trapped, but there are exceptions. And I compared it to, there was a time when rock bands were doing concept albums, right? And double albums and triple albums. That was a disastrous decision for most of them. But in the hands of The Clash, in the hands of Prince, in the hands of Magnetic Fields, bring it on. The more songs, the better. So I feel that's true with the best tasting menus. If you're talking about, frankly, Noma in Copenhagen, or what Enrique Olvera does in Mexico City, what Eric Ripert does at Le Bernardin, well, actually, it can be an enlightening and sort of life-affirming experience. And Naka in Los Angeles is a great example. I love what Nikki Nakayama does. I love Le Comptoir in Koreatown in Los Angeles. I had a tasting menu experience there that in some ways informed what I wrote for Esquire because it was just deliriously wonderful, but short. I remember it being basically about 90 minutes, five courses. Almost everything came from the chef's garden in Long Beach. And it left us feeling energized instead of tied down by boulders.
Yeah, that's Gary Menace's place.
Yeah, he's great.
I haven't been there yet, but I will be going there because I heard it's possible to survive. I do not have the kind of constitution that can deal with more than 10, probably not even 10. I think for me, 5 is pretty great.
5 is perfect. That's what Le Comptoir has, is like 5 or 6. Contra in New York's Lower East Side tends to be 5 or 6. I mean, it's funny you mentioned it. It's not just that we may not have the bandwidth in terms of appetite for all these many courses, but some friends of mine just simply don't have the attention span. The inspiration for this particular column in Esquire came when a friend of mine, he's a Hollywood executive guy, and he said, you know, what's a place in New York that I should be eating at? And I suggested a place that's quite hot right now. And he made a reservation. He texted me about a half an hour later and said, I'm sorry, this is kind of a jerk move, but I'm backing out. And I was like, oh, man, that's really rude. What, you know, that's not cool. And he was like, I just heard it was a 4-hour tasting menu. I don't have the constitution for that. I don't have the patience. I can't do it. He's like, please don't make me do it. Please, Jeff, I'm so sorry. And I was like, I'm not going to make you, okay? But he has plenty of money. The obstacle is he just didn't want to sit through.
Yeah.
You know, and also people like choice, you know. My two favorite restaurants in New York City are Via Carota in the West Village and Prune in the East Village. It's all choice, and it's all seasonal. The menus change very frequently. You go in there, you order a great array of vegetables, pastas, whatever. It's just pleasurable to be able to choose and, you know, steer the ship a little bit.
So give us your top 10 tasting menus, which I imagine you have steered for those of us who may not have the constitution for whatever reason, if it's our bank account or our attention spans.
I mean, basically, to me, the ideal tasting menu is fast, cheap, and out of control. You know, it's just like you're in, you're out. So, I mean, some that we have on the list are Le Comptoir in Koreatown in Los Angeles. We have Contra in New York. We have Blanca in Brooklyn. We have a place called Addison down near San Diego that blew me away, actually. Have you been to Addison?
No, not yet. You're blowing me away.
See, the chef is named William Bradley. I hadn't heard much about him. The guy is so skilled. He's like a protege of Thomas Keller's. Very traditional, very classic sort of Cali French sort of thing. A lot of the ingredients come from Chino Farms, which is down there and supplied produce to Alice Waters and Thomas Keller, famously. Just a beautiful meal. There was a lot of caviar and truffles, and that there was that sort of traditional luxury element. But it wasn't heavy. I love Providence in Los Angeles, of course. I'm a big fan of Elena Regan in Chicago, who has a restaurant called Elizabeth.
Well, don't you feel that one of the reasons chefs do this is to stretch themselves and sort of we've signed on to their exploration as opposed to going to a restaurant and ordering a plate of something that you know you're going to love because you've had it before and it plays to you as a regular at that establishment. This is sort of the opposite of that.
That's such an incredibly good point because the fact is a tasting menu, when done well, can push you out of your comfort zone. Most of us associate food with comfort. You know what I mean? That's why we keep going back to dumplings and pasta and whatnot. We love the comfort of that, particularly in a world gone mad. The conflict here, I think, has to do with a sort of dynamic between challenge and ego. You know, sometimes you're taking the ride on a tasting menu and you feel like, this is terrific. I never would have thought of those combinations of flavors. I never would have imagined those textures. My mind is being opened. When a tasting menu is going horribly awry, you feel like somebody's just inflicting his ego on you. You know what I mean? It's like, no, stop, please, you know?
Well, I have to thank you for showing us the other way. So people do understand that they don't have to start. They don't have to jump in with a 4-hour experience. And knowing that, I think, is part of the exploration.
Yes. When the chefs focus largely on vegetables, seafood, fruit, etc., you know, you end up feeling better.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff.
Hey, thank you, Evan. It's really fun to talk to you. I love your show. I love what you do.
Find a link to Jeff Gordonier's article, Tasting Menus Are Bullshit, Except When They're Not, on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we return to one of my favorite tools of the trade in the kitchen, the trusty cast iron skillet. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Recently, I looked at my vast collection of cookware and decided to downsize. A couple cast iron pieces became the centerpiece of a new, leaner collection. They're incredibly versatile and practically indestructible. Home cook and food writer Charlotte Druckman has countless reasons for loving on that heavy metal. So before we get into cooking in cast iron in our own kitchen, could you kind of give us an idea of where else in the world it's used and what the pots might look like?
It is used in so many places, and I think we take it for granted because it's such an American icon, just even as an industry. But if you just start thinking about, even think of a flatbread that you like, you know, like I think of how in India, the tawa, you know, that you make flatbreads on is usually a cast iron piece. Go back to China, because I think that's actually where the first sort of cast iron pieces came from, and you'll find things that look more like cauldrons that are cast iron. You see in South America cast iron pots being used all the time. I don't want to say every culture has cast iron, but if you think about each culture and a food that you like, and then you start to kind of go back and do the math, you may end up tripping over cast iron at some point, is what I realize. Even now, Japan has its own version of cast iron skillets that are a bit lighter weight than ours, but they are beautiful.
And that's the thing. Once you get over the idea of, oh, this is so heavy. Oh, where am I going to keep it in my house where it's going to hold its sheen and I'm not going to ruin the surface. Once you get over that, then, I mean, I just leave mine on my stove all the time. I use it.
Me too.
Then I wash it. Then I put it on a burner because it just looks so awesome.
It looks awesome. It's the pan I think you reach the most for. A lot of the times it's sort of, you have to deduce if you're not going to use it, not if you are going to use it. It's such the default for so many things that I often have to, when I'm recipe testing and I have to print a recipe for publication, I often have to ask myself if cast iron is really the appropriate, we can put that in quotes, pans, because I would rather just do it in my cast iron if I can.
And I have to say, I always feel like there's so much memory and life imbued into the iron. Like the two pieces that I use the most, I bought secondhand.
Yes.
So they had a whole story before I got to them.
Did you get to learn and did you know anything about them?
No, but I have this wonderful like 8-inch griddle.
Yeah.
And it's just perfect for eggs and for pancakes. And I just know that thing was used over and over and over again.
You can tell.
Yeah. Let's choose a pan. For many people, they're just going to get one. So what is the size that seems to be the most utilitarian?
I found for baking, I did every single recipe in the cookbook I did in the 10-inch skillet. And I think it's a great starting pan if you are maybe cooking regularly savory food for 2 to 3 people and you plan to bake all the time. If you're someone who is going to use your cast iron to make meals for a larger family, I think a 12-inch is probably where you're going to start. But I personally use the 10-inch because I bake in it a lot.
When you buy a new one, do you get the pre-seasoned?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are very few places in which you actually even have a choice. Most of them now just come pre-seasoned. That's kind of their thing. And it really depends on the skillet. I'm a little bit on the fence about it. Lodge used to make these just such beautiful pieces. I mean, the same as Wagner and Griswold. So if you go back and you get a vintage lodge, which will not have been pre-seasoned, you may actually find that you enjoy cooking on it more than the new ones, which do come pre-seasoned. And you don't really have a choice there. They're completely functional. They're enduring. They're great. But it's funny because I actually am finding that I don't always prefer pre-seasoned.
Yeah, sometimes you want to start on your own. And these days, there's so many really detailed instructions online.
Yes, I think almost sometimes too many instructions. I think it can scare people off a little.
You do?
A little bit, yeah. Just because I think once you get started, you realize that it's actually relatively low maintenance. It's just you have to just be consistent. And I think sometimes when you go online and you start seeing all of that information, it starts to feel like you're taking on a big project.
Okay, so we finally have our skillet. We've chosen something, and we've decided that we're going to, instead of make fried eggs the first time we use it, we're going to use it for baking. So let's do something simple. And first of all, I have to say that for baking, it's like Instagram ready. It's so beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
What do you think is one of the easiest things somebody can start with that will just make them go, okay, I've fallen in love with this whole idea?
Well, I think you have two choices. I think if you are someone who is not that into baking, or you think you're not into baking, I tell people to do the flatbreads first. And I would actually say to do a naan, a very simple naan. It doesn't have to be a complicated thing, but it's instant gratification because you don't even have to turn on your oven. And you just literally see this thing become bread right in front of your eyes. And I think that that is a form of magic. And for me, that was what first got me really excited about my skillet. If you're talking about something that feels a little bit more like a baking project with a batter, I still think you can't fail with cornbread. I think there's something about making cornbread in a skillet that is just immensely satisfying. It's also a very good way to season the pan because you do use a significant amount of fat. So you're really getting a nice coating on your cast iron skillet. And I would say it's better to start with something like that than it is an egg because of the proteins in eggs. They're actually more prone to stick on cast iron. So the better seasoned your pan is, the more you've made cornbread in the pan, the better it will be for things like fried eggs. Like they'll just start coming right off your pan too.
What if I want to make something like an upside down cake or sticky buns where I have something on the bottom that's real sugary and syrupy maybe? Do I need to worry about that or do anything differently than I would if I were baking it in a cake pan, for example?
No, and I had that same fear when I started. I just kept thinking, how the hell is this not going to stick? How am I not going to have some just sticky morass of jamminess or caramel that I'm going to be crying, trying to get out? And you're fine, especially because a lot of those toppings tend to have a little bit of butter in them mixed in with the sugar. But if your pan has been seasoned, it doesn't even have to be the most perfectly seasoned, aged skillet. You're going to do those upside down cakes and they come right out. And it kind of feels like a miracle every time it happens.
I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I really had moments in my kitchen because, I was relatively new to cast iron when I took on this book. So I'm kind of living proof that you could be converted to cast iron, but also that cast iron works. Because if I could do it, and I really am a spaz, I know that it's real. I know that other people are going to have no problem with their upside down cake, and they will think it's a miracle.
Are you always preheating the pan?
You are almost always preheating the pan. A lot of sticking is actually the result of having put something cold onto a cold pan and then put the cold pan into the hot oven or onto the stove. So most of the time you do want to preheat it, and you want to always preheat it slowly. So if you want to preheat something that you're going to be baking in your oven, I always say put the pan in the oven when you turn the oven on to preheat your oven. So they preheat at the same time. Similarly, on the stove, I will start it on very low and then I'll gradually increase it. And I will often even think about rotating the pan around the flame a little bit because it avoids getting hot spots.
Let's talk about pizza dough or focaccia, like the Big Sur focaccia. You know, so people are so into like stones. Do I get a stone? Do I get a steel? What is the benefit of using the cast iron pan?
I think that the cast iron pan gets you pretty darn close. And if you're talking about investing in a stone, which is big and heavy, or the baking steel, which is more expensive, maybe takes up less room, but it too is really heavy, you can get the same thing done on the cast iron. And what I like about the cast iron that can't be said for something like, you know, the stone or I guess even the steel is you don't get the sort of out exterior edges to have that nice sort of crispiness because it's flat, right? Whereas the pan has sides that could contain the dough. So when you do a focaccia and it's actually in that pan, you get that crust that forms not just on the base, but also around the actual sides of the focaccia. And for the pizza, you're actually turning the pan over and you can use it just like you would the steel or a stone.
Okay, so now we've made some beautiful items in our cast iron pan. How do we season it?
The nice thing about the cast iron is that if you're making most things you cook in it tend to start with some kind of fat on the hot pan. And that in itself is already helping to season your pan, which is good news. So a lot of what goes into seasoning it properly is really about not messing up the seasoning you already have. That means that when you clean it, you don't want to use things like steel wool. You don't want to use anything really abrasive on it. And you can use dish soap. People seem surprised by this. I think for a long time it was thought that dish soap was not okay. So, you know, you want to clean it out and then you need to dry it thoroughly. That's really, really important because rust is the devil. If your pan gets rusted, you then have to remove your beautiful seasoning and start all over again, which is not a hard thing. It's just who wants to do that? Who wants to undo all of those beautiful layers? And then what I do is I put it on the stove over low heat for about 5 minutes, which does two things. It ensures that if there was any water that I had missed in the pan, it's been completely dried out. But it also sort of opens the pores of the pan so that then when you add a little bit of oil and you're just adding maybe a teaspoon tops, and then you're going to coat the surface using even just like a paper towel or a cloth. If you do that sort of every time you're done using the pan, especially when you first get started, that's going to be the best way to sort of maintain a seasoning. If you buy a pan that's new, that isn't seasoned, or if you buy a really old pan and you have to clean it out and start over again, that same thing of rinsing out the pan and then coating it with the oil, you do, except this time you then go put it in an oven at about 450 degrees for an hour. And you do that 3 times. But in this day and age, it's rare that a pan, you buy a new pan, you would even have to do that.
Charlotte Druckmann's new cookbook, it is devoted entirely to the cast iron skillet, is Stir, Sizzle, Bake. Find her pistachio cherry Danish recipe on the Good Food blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Now it's time for our weekly restaurant review. Jonathan Gold, where are you taking us?
We're going to Arenia, which is a Filipino restaurant in Santa Ana.
So let's start by talking about the anchovies.
The first time I went there, I sort of wandered in the late afternoon, and it was completely empty except for a table of sort of older Filipino guys who were eating anchovies, plain toasted anchovies. They're really tiny. They're really pungent. It comes with a sort of chili vinegar you can dip it in. And they were drinking beer, and it seemed like an idyllic way to spend the afternoon eating these dillis.
Yeah. So did you follow their lead?
I did. The interesting thing about the anchovies was that you could do it the way that one usually does it when you have dried fish as a snack, which is to, you know, pop salty handfuls into your mouth and crunch and drink beer. But I was really impressed by this sort of contemplative way that the people across the room were eating it, which is, you know, they dip a head and they crunch the head and they crunch the rest of the fish. Maybe they eat one fish without the vinegar. Maybe they completely douse it. But when you're eating them one by one and contemplating each, you know, millimeter of their tiny bodies, you sort of begin to understand that they're not a handful of things like potato chips. They are individual things that once had tiny little individual souls. And you're tasting some of that. You're absorbing some of that when you're eating that.
And then I guess you also get to contemplate what's coming next.
You do. They have peanuts that are roasted in a shell with chili and vinegar and sea salt and something sweet. So, you know, opening them also becomes a contemplative act. They have a really good version of sinigang, which is, you know, the famous Filipino soup of broth, in this case, pork broth that's been soured a little with tamarind. And often there'll be all kinds of innards in it, but this time there's only just a little bit of bok choy. And if you're there in the afternoon, you're probably eating rice bowls, which is to say the things that the restaurant has for dinner, but on rice and as an individual thing instead of a sharing plate.
So you were there both at lunch and dinner?
Oh, yeah. I took full advantage of it.
Are the ingredients farmers market sourced?
They're definitely farmers market sourced. The chef, Ryan Garlitos, worked with Carlos Salgado at Taco Maria for a long time.
Excellent pedigree.
Really excellent pedigree. He had the idea that he'd be able to do for Filipino cooking, the often maligned Filipino cooking, what Carlos did for Mexican food. And so there are a lot of traditional recipes that are brought up a little bit by using, you know, super good farmers market produce.
So what were some of your favorite small plates?
They do a nice version of the vegetable dish called kare kare. Kare kare is usually a dish of oxtail stewed with peanuts. And here they do it with charred chunks of cauliflower where you'd expect the meat. It's delicious. The pancit, which is usually sort of a generic bowl of noodles, although man, is it good at Lhasa up in Chinatown. They're chewy and they're house-made noodles that they garnish sort of minimally with citrus and snips of fried chicken skin. And it comes out looking like a plate of Italian pasta, but the sour, savory flavor is very, very Filipino.
They add a soft-boiled egg to it?
There's always a soft-boiled egg. I always forget about that.
But to me, that's like a Filipino carbonara.
It is like a Filipino carbonara. And the version that the Valencias do up at Lhasa, I actually describe as a Filipino carbonara. And his is a little less carbonara-ish than that one, but it's still definitely in that family. You can get a big deep-fried turkey leg, which is the last thing you'd expect at a Filipino restaurant. But it comes with a Swedish sauce thickened with chicken liver that tastes like Filipino giblet gravy.
Oh, that sounds so good.
It's something that you would probably expect to find with pork, but it's given like a little bit of twist with the turkey leg. It's scaled back a bit, but you're always close to the fish sauce patis, which is like garum or like Vietnamese fish sauce. There's always a bugung, which is the fermented shrimp paste, which is really strong. And there's a lot of calamansi lime, which has obviously the acidity, but also like a nice fresh fragrance. Even when you're dealing with like a little head of lettuce that's been charred to a fare thee well on the grill, it's smeared with a paste made of Filipino milkfish and tossed with kare-kare orange, which has a little bit of sweetness, and something that looks like a streusel, but is actually made with anchovy. So you're getting something that looks like a Western salad, but tastes like anything but.
It's really interesting to me that it's taken this long for white people to be able to start to accept Filipino food. And it's fascinating to sort of using the farmer's market, using that cultural marker as a way in to get acceptance of the more pungent aspects of the cuisine.
Yeah, I've got a lot of theories about that. One of them is probably that even bad Thai food is pretty good, so that when you have even good, bad Vietnamese food is pretty good. So when you have people like bringing that up to sort of, you know, modern expensive restaurant standards, and this place isn't expensive at all, but up to like chefly standards, you're dealing with something that's maybe better, maybe worse, but it's conceivable of liking the original better. I think Filipino cooking in its first generation stage is perhaps less palatable to a palate not used to the, you know, million gradations of sourness, not used to the pungency of the fish sauces, not used to the frequent use of bitter greens, and frankly, the really, really extensive use of offal.
Yeah, it can be challenging for folks who aren't adventurous.
This restaurant does a version of dinuguan, which is usually the most fearsome dish to people who don't know about Filipino cooking. It's a stew usually of pig innards in a really strong pungent sauce made with pork blood and ground liver. But Garlitos lightens the super dark sauce. And you taste the Livermore's faint seasoning than you do as the absolute pungent essence of it. And instead of the intestines and hearts and stuff, you get crisp edge slices of, you know, roast pork shoulder, which is really delicious.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is dining this week at Irania in Santa Ana. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Would you sip a glass of wine that's made without a single grape? We consider that question when our show continues. Don't turn that dial. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. The terroir at Ava Winery in San Francisco doesn't boast rich soil or a microclimate, but rather test tubes and Bunsen burners. Ava wines are synthetic, engineered in a lab, and they don't contain a single grape. It's enough to make Bacchus's head roll. One of the founders, Alec Lee, gives us the rundown on how the wine gets made. As I understand the process, there's no fermentation, no grapes, yet you can literally turn water into wine in 15 minutes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. There's no grapes. There's no yeast in the process. We start with water, and then we start adding all sorts of molecular components that are found in wine, but that aren't sourced from wine.
Okay, so what does that mean? Are there everything is a synthetic molecule?
No, in fact, we anticipate that pretty much everything, hopefully everything, will actually be a naturally derived compound. So essentially what we've done is said, if we look at wine, indeed any other food, it's a collection of molecules. And so the challenge here is in identifying what those molecules are and in quantifying them. And once we can solve that problem, then it's really just a question of where do we source them from? So what we found is that these compounds are present in much more scalable and sustainable crops, or they can be produced by other microorganisms that are still, of course, naturally derived, but that don't have the resource, the water, the time, intensivity that wine requires. And so we can source each of these different components from various other places and recombine them from scratch so that it is chemically identical to wine, but it didn't come from grapes fermented by yeast.
Okay, now I know you don't want to give me the recipe and you don't want to reveal too much, obviously, but give me an idea of one of these plants, for example, from which you're taking molecules that have the same aromatics, I would imagine, and taste.
Well, one of my favorites is a compound called ethyl hexanoate. And ethyl hexanoate sounds like a kind of scary molecule, but it is the exact same compound that makes pineapples smell and to some extent taste like pineapples. And it's a compound that's also found in wines. And so it doesn't necessarily have to come from pineapple. It turns out that a lot of different organisms can produce this. But of course, pineapples are one source from which a compound like this can be derived. Grapes are the most expensive agricultural crop. And so when we can start identifying some of these other crops that are much more high yielding of some of these compounds, then it just becomes a matter of sourcing them and extracting them and recombining them.
Is it alcoholic?
It is. We add alcohol to it. Right now we're working with highly pure distilled ethanol, and it comes from grain, corn, but it doesn't come from grapes.
Okay. So you used the example of a pineapple. So that is going to give you a very particular nose. Did you choose one type of varietal or one type of blend of wine to emulate?
We're working with multiple. So right now we're working with a Moscato d'Asti, we're working with a Champagne, we're working on a Pinot Noir, a Sauvignon Blanc. And so there is a lot of overlap in terms of the compounds that are present. You know, there's some compounds that are basically present in all wines. And then there's some that are varietally specific. And then there's some that might be specific to a particular vintage. And so the choices that we make will matter a lot in terms of the final product. What we're working on right now is a lot of the research and development is figuring out how to identify and how to properly quantify a lot of the compounds. And so we don't really need to make very conscious choices about exactly the thing that we're looking to emulate, because once the process is validated, then we'll be able to apply it to all sorts of vintages, and it'll be a much easier step to go from bottle to bottle.
So what is your background? Are you a chemist?
I studied biotechnology, and I ran two different companies before this. And my co-founder also is very technical. He also studied biotechnology, worked in molecular bioengineering. And so, you know, both of us are coming to this with a very chemist-oriented background.
So have you had an aha moment yet where you watched the clear liquid water transform itself into either straw-colored or ruby-colored liquid that you handed to somebody and somebody said, oh my goodness?
Yeah, absolutely. We haven't given anyone a clear liquid yet. We have plenty of clear liquids that we work with. But of course, when we give it to someone to taste, the color of the liquid actually matters a lot in terms of how you experience it. And so everything that we're giving to people to taste is appropriately colored. I'd say that's probably the easiest problem to solve. And absolutely, when we do our taste tests, a lot of the time people can't tell the difference between the real wine and our wine. And so I think that's a very jarring moment, if you will, for a lot of people to say, what do you mean this didn't come from grapes? It tastes exactly like a wine.
Which leads me to ask the question, are you going to be able to call it wine?
That's something that we're still working on. You know, the regulatory bodies that exist around alcohol have pretty strict rules about what can be called wine, under what circumstances, and from where. And so I can't really make any promises right now, but I do have essentially confirmation that we will be able to sell our product. The question is just what we'll have to label it. But the thing for us is that it doesn't really matter too much if we can call it wine or not, because at the end of the day, what matters is market acceptance. And so if people relate to it as wine, understand that it's wine, then I think the regulation will catch up to reality, which is that wine is probably the most appropriate way to describe this on a molecular level.
Who do you see as your most accepting consumer? When I think of people who are really into wine, I think of people who are so linked to sort of the whole mythos of the land and the vines and the climate all coming together in this, you know, perfect expression. What you're doing has a different passion. There's a lot of desire to solve sustainability issues, I can see. Do you think eco-warriors are going to be your first people to embrace it?
I would say as a group, millennials are probably the customer target right now. And I think that there's a very strong precedent for narrative substitution among millennials. They don't buy products the same way that their parents did, and they don't think about products in the same way that their parents did. So one of the key advantages, of course, is the sustainability. But I think that we will be able to sort of substitute the marketing narrative, if you will, around terroir, the history of vineyards. These are things that certainly matter still to a lot of people and to a lot of millennials. But I think that as we can show that those things don't actually have an objective impact on the product itself, that is, that we can generate a product of equivalent quality without those things, and we can do it more sustainably at a lower price, that will really resonate with the millennial cohort.
Now, you and your partner don't have a background in wine. Do you have expertise that you're tapping to sort of bring you closer to some of the flavor profiles, or are you just going by compounds?
We absolutely have a wine expert who actually joined us as a co-founder as well. A couple of months into the project, we realized that we could only get so far. We had made a lot of assumptions about the compounds that we identified that we would need or that we wouldn't need. And it turns out that a lot of those were wrong, and that we identified a lot more about the complexity of the wine, how to think about the mouthfeel, how to think about some of the aromatic compounds that individually actually smell very bad, but when they're in a wine, actually add a lot of very interesting positive characters to it. And so our third co-founder, Josh, is a certified sommelier, and we sort of tapped him a while ago. We asked him if he was looking to sink his teeth into something that was very new, still in the wine industry, and he was just very excited about doing something that hadn't really been done before like this.
Wow, it's so fascinating. You know, there's a part of this that kind of reminds me of perfumery, the idea of creating something out of air in a way, using compounds that are aromas, aromatics.
I would say that there's a great deal of similarity between what the perfume industry does and what the flavor industry does. That is, you have individuals, often with chemistry backgrounds as well, who have excellent noses and go in with analytical chemistry equipment, and they start sort of picking apart aromas and flavors that we find in nature and trying to recreate them. I think what the flavor industry does as a whole is very interesting. It's much more on a proprietary flavor development basis. And so we weren't really able to outsource a lot of that work in the same way that, you know, a giant food manufacturer might request a new flavor be developed. And I think that at the end of the day, the product that we'll be able to show for it, having been developed in-house, will be of a much higher quality and complexity than if we tried to outsource it.
So when will we be able to buy a bottle of your grapeless wine? And about what would the price point be?
So we're hoping to be able to get to market within the next year. A lot of that, as we talked about, depends on the regulatory status, and we're still working on the R&D. So it's tough for me to make promises right now, but that's our goal. And my goal ultimately is to be able to get it down to below $10 a bottle. I'd like for people to be able to buy two bottles for less than $20, but also no promises on that right now. We do already know that we can produce it much more affordably and much faster than any other wine. And so I do anticipate significant cost advantages on that front.
Alec Lee is making wine without a single grape at Ava Winery in San Francisco. You actually might be able to taste it later this year. So would you? Find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram and let us know. Search for our handle, KCRW's Good Food. Next, it's time to hit the road with a seasoned food and travel journalist. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. That's an African proverb that any food and travel journalist can appreciate. Shane Mitchell has worked for Food and Leisure and Savour. Now, she's compiled the stories of the food and the people she encountered around the world in a lovely book. It's called Far Afield. You often document groups that are a bit isolated and marginalized. And you say that this was a 10-year labor of love. Why was it so important for you to compile these particular accounts?
Well, I felt that the profiles in this book are people that represent communities where keeping the food chain vital is still a daily chore. And these are the people that are really rooted in their landscape and their culture. That, to me, characterized what was important about going so far out in the world to discover them.
Of all of the stories in the book, I noticed that you have two that take place in Kenya. Maybe you can describe those two.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Kenya is actually a really diverse part of Africa. So in many ways, what I was able to do was capture two different cultures in one region. The first was Swahili culture, which is the east coast of Africa. That takes place in Lamu, which is an archipelago just north of Mombasa and south of the Somalian border. And it's characterized by a beautiful style of cooking that is a fusion of many different cultures that have sort of wound up or washed up on that shore. And the other chapter is about the Maasai warriors and observing them coming across the border from Tanzania into the Mara region, which is the savannas that stretch from the depths of South Africa all the way up to Ethiopia.
As you've been doing this kind of traveling, particularly with the photographer, because the photographs are really incredible, who photographed for you?
That's James Fisher. He and I have collaborated on a regular basis since we met on an assignment in Australia in 2009.
When you travel like this, I would imagine the holy grail is to get invited into people's daily life, into their home, and to get to really see how they live, where they live, what they're eating, how they cook it. What was a really sort of high moment for you where basically you were grabbed by a stranger and told, come here and hang out with us and watch me do this?
That's every day. it's funny because, everyone has to eat. And I find that one of the universals in life is a sense of hospitality. And for me, even when you're a stranger, people are kinder than you would expect, especially when you're really far out in the world. So that actually happened over and over and over again. It would be hard to pin one specific place.
Why don't you describe the woman who you met in Rajasthan?
Ah, yeah, Mantra. Her name is Mantra Ram, and she belongs to a tribal group that are called the Rabari. The Rabari are traditional herders, and they herd camels, sheep, and goats. And we were driving through Rajasthan, actually. It was on an assignment for Savour. And we were basically told to explore Rajasthan for the magazine. I've been in that region before, but never that far out into the country. And we were just roaring through a village with a guy who was our driver, and that turned out to be his home village, so we stopped. And he said, well, let's go to my best friend's house and we'll talk to them. And that's how I met Mantra, who is a really strong, powerful woman. She's just an intense, lovely person. She's got a great laugh. And she just invited me into her kitchen and I got to watch her make porridge for dinner.
So you had these sort of moments of just regular daily life, but you also had moments where you got to witness the sacred.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that that included a Shinto communion.
Yes, in many ways, food really has a sacred aspect. And one of the things that I felt was important was trying to document that as well. So I went to a shrine in Kyoto. Kamigamo is the nickname for the shrine. And it's actually the oldest one in Kyoto. So that particular chapter is about transitioning from the mundane world to a mystical plane, because Shinto is Japan's indigenous religion, and it's essentially nature worship. So every morning, the priests at the shrine perform a ceremony that converses with the temple's guiding spirit, and that spirit just happens to be a favorite of farmers who pray for a bountiful harvest. And it was truly exceptional.
As you travel like this with James Fisher, the photographer, do you find that sometimes subjects are resistant to being photographed?
Not really, but what we did have to do is sort of respect certain cultural mores from place to place. Like, for instance, in India and also in East Africa, some women have to practice certain modest behaviors on the street. So, you know, some of them are veiled or semi-veiled. And we had to ask their permission to make sure that it was okay, because obviously, you know, they're appearing in a book and that could cause problems if the family, and sometimes the head of the family, who's a man, didn't approve of them being photographed.
As you traveled through all these different global communities, how were you able to get access and get invitations into some of these moments? Did they tend to happen like they did with your driver, where it just is serendipity? Or did you have to go through sort of a series of fixers and a lot of work beforehand?
Some of it really, Evan, is just dumb luck and, you know, being in the right place at the right time. But mostly in the case of some of the other individuals that I've profiled, it basically means that I've spent many years trying to get into specific communities. So it's going back and back and back to a place and getting to know people and getting to gain their trust. You know, like any other journalist, I certainly have my fixers. And sometimes they're just locals who I happen to know. For instance, in Hawaii, the chapter on Hawaii is about the Makchu family. And I've just been going to the Big Island of Hawaii for over 20 years. So eventually, someone who's related to the Makchu said, hey, you know, if you want to write about tarot, this is the couple you need to meet. And that's how that came about.
So tell me about them.
Ah, they're lovely people. They're really marvelous. Jason and Alberta Makchu live in a part of the Big Island of Hawaii called Waipio Valley, which is, again, it's actually a sacred place. It's considered very special to the Hawaiians. And Jason and Alberta grow taro there, which they then grind and then ferment and turn into poi, which is one of the staples of the Hawaiian diet. And they've just been living there almost their entire... Jason grew up in Waipio. Alberta, who's Portuguese Hawaiian, grew up in a town nearby, and they met in high school. And they've lived in this small farm ever since. And I go back every year, or I try to see them.
Do they do this just for their own small community, or is there a commercial aspect of the business?
There is a commercial aspect, but I mean, it's not like it ever makes it to the mainland. Their poi is actually, and this is kind of marvelous, their poi is actually sold at Costco in Kona. But it's such a small production, and usually it's by subscription. So the people who really like their poi will let them know that they need 1, 2, 3 bags a week. And their daughter, Kahealani, actually takes it around out of the valley and then delivers it to their subscribers.
I love that, a poi subscription.
It's like a CSA of Hawaii.
Could you share another story from the book?
Oh, sure. One of my favorite places, and again, this is a place I continue to go back to, is Iceland. It's such a weird and crazy landscape, and the people are just as quirky. And they have this rich, deep, dark vein of humor. And you never know it because they come across immediately as very stoic. And so it takes a long time to get to know that they're actually hilarious people. And what I was doing there was documenting a tradition that takes place in the fall. It's called the Retir, which means to search in Icelandic. And essentially what they do is all the sheep on the island are free range. There's no fences, really. There's no restrictions on the sheep. They just graze wherever they want during the Icelandic summer. And just as sort of the Arctic winds start blowing and the door slams on the barn, the Icelandic people go out and hunt for the sheep to drive them back to the farms for the winter. So I joined one particular farmer and his friends in a bungalow up near one of the glaciers and hunted for sheep way up in the highlands. And it was really an extraordinary experience to hang out with these modern-day Vikings and hunt sheep on horseback.
What did you end up eating during that period?
A lot of lamb. One of my favorite things now is this particular type of smoked sliced lamb that they have in Iceland. It's called hangjok. It's their version of a salami sandwich. They slap it between two pieces of flatbread and smear it with butter. And it's just gorgeous.
With photographer James Fisher, Shane Mitchell wrote Far Afield, Rare Food Encounters from Around the World. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to it on our website or KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, many thanks to the Good Food team. They are
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.